welcome to Worlds Apart. The wars fought by Israel and by Ukraine seem to have little in common beyond American military support, but at their core, they may be driven by very similar collective ethos of victimhood and entitlement rooted in the horrors of the Second World War. In both cases, national identities have been derived from and fostered by the sense of an existential threat. Is reconciliation with neighbors even possible within such a worldview? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Yakov Rapkin, Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Montreal. Professor Rapkin, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for being available.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Now, you've written several books on the interplay of religious and political narratives in the history of modern Israel. And one of the most interesting discoveries for me personally was how crucial the Jews from the Russian Empire and later on from the Soviet Union were to the rise of Zionist ideology, especially because they weren't particularly religious, and yet they happened to be one of the staunchest supporters of the idea of the holy or promised land. How do you explain this unusual synergy?
Well, you have to realize that those founders of the State of Israel, and before that, the Zionist project in Palestine, came from the Pale of Settlement in the Russian Empire, which is today's Ukraine, Moldova, Belarusia, and the Baltic republics. They went to Palestine because of violence in the Russian Empire, violence directed at Jews. The first wave, serious wave, was after the assassination of Alexander II in 1881. And the second one was around the first Russian Revolution. This is 1905. And what was really traumatizing for many people in the Pale of Settlement is that while under Alexander II, there were certain liberal reforms, including, as you know, liberation of the serfs, but also concerning Jews. So there was a future for Jews in the Russian Empire. And when pogroms emerged in the wake of the assassination of the emperor, it shook, really shook a lot of Jews. Now, you have to realize that we are talking about millions of people in the Pale of Settlement, and they lived largely in small towns. And then those small towns, there was tremendous diversity between very observant traditional Jews and a very active secularized youth. But unlike Jews in France, for example, they couldn't move to St. Petersburg, they couldn't move to Moscow and become intellectuals and become join the Russian mainstream because of the Pale of Settlement.
Mm-hmm. So Professor Rapkin, do I understand you correctly that for them, this idea of a land where they can be freely themselves, where they can practice their culture, their religion, it was truly attractive. It wasn't just a political project for them. It was to some extent religious, but it was also a way of just living with dignity.
No, I'll get to it in a moment. I'll answer your question. So these young people were utterly secularized. There were many of them were militantly atheist, and many of them acquired experience of political terrorism among the social revolutionaries, among other revolutionary groups in Russia. So this is the youth that went to Palestine. They wanted to build a new society, a new Hebrew, a new language, and a new man who would be, unlike Jews in the Pale of Settlement, would be strong, muscular, almost Aryan, if I may say so. So the image was to build a very, very different society. And in order to build that society, and I think for people who are familiar with Soviet history, they recognize some of the traits. So to build that society, they didn't want to join the existing economy and society in Palestine. They built a separate society. And in order to do so, they had wonderful socialist slogans like, we'll conquer the land with labor. Well, it sounds really good. What it really meant, it meant that jobs should be given to Jewish settlers who went to Palestine. So it created tremendous antagonism and hostility from Arab Palestinians.
And I know that you've written in your books that they had considerable success in penetrating the highest echelons of power and moving Israeli politics to the nationalist right over many decades. Now, what do you think allowed them to, on the one hand, be so successful and so forthright in achieving what they want to achieve, and yet at the same time to preserve that sense of utter insecurity and an existential threat that I think is still very key to the far-right ideology?
They wanted to leave the past behind, but no one succeeds doing that. So they brought with them to Palestine two important experiences. One is the political terrorism that I mentioned to you. The other one was the sense of powerlessness due to the pogroms. And that's a very explosive mix. And you could see that till today. That on the one hand, there was intrepid military action. On the other, we're the victims. So this is what was brought from Palestine. And of course, the feeling of victimhood was amplified as a result of the Nazi genocide during the Second World War.
Now, as you wrote, they were largely estranged from Judaism. They considered themselves to be of Jewish nationality and were often quite unabashed about ethnic nationalism and the use of force to impose it. And it reminds me a little bit of the current Ukrainian nationalism, which is also sort of more religious than political in nature. And by that, I mean that it favors devotion and this sort of the passion more than actual practicality, for which Jews have been known for over centuries. I don't want to sort of be very stereotypical, but typically Jewish people are associated with the ability to do business, to be practical, to, you know, make reasonable compromises. Do you see any similarities there?
Well, they come from the same area of Eastern Europe where ethnic nationalism was rife at the end of the 19th and 20th centuries. Ethnic nationalism was the foundation on which many of the states following the Versailles Treaty were established on the borderlands of the Soviet Union. As I don't think that there is much comparison as far as today's world is concerned, because in Israel, about which I know more than about the Ukraine, in Israel, it has been cultivated for many years. The school programs, everything was done in order to prove that anti-Semitism is endemic in the world, that without the state, a state for themselves, they would be exterminated, they would suffer. This is exactly what I think most Jewish Israelis believe. And I think that's why the situation with Ukraine is very different. I think that we are not talking about the threat of Ukrainians being expelled from Ukraine. I mean, that's not the issue. Whereas in the case of Israel, many Israeli Jews believe that the only safe place for Jews is Israel. Of course, the tragic attack on the 7th of October by Hamas shook that belief very seriously. And we'll see when it's all over, we'll see what effect it will have on Israeli society.
I don't know if you would agree with that, but I think what's central to these far-right sensibilities is this not only the trauma concept, and I think it's hard to find, honestly, people who haven't suffered some kind of trauma, but there's some kind of sort of sticking to that trauma as if it's become not only sacred, but central to national identity. And God forbid it's attempted to be healed, because that may in itself be perceived as a betrayal of national identity. Is there something I mean, how do you explain that phenomenon? And do you think it's been manipulated for political reasons, making sure that trauma, collective trauma, remains forever and ever, and that people remain forever aggrieved?
I think there is something of it, because in most Israeli schools, there are classes that teach history in a certain way, which leads all Jewish history to the establishment of the State of Israel, and they lived happily ever after. So this is the idea. And at the same time, there's a lot of teaching concerning the powerlessness of the Jews, be it in the Pale of Settlement in Russia or during the Second World War in Europe. Because in Europe, you have to remember, it's not only Germany. We're talking most of the massacres took place at actually outside of Germany. And there were not too many Germans in the Babi Yar in Kiev. So there were a lot of local people doing it. And I think that is also taught in Israel, with the conclusion that the only safe place is Israel. So that trauma, in a way, works politically in a very important manner. Because Zionism, political Zionism, is based on the idea that Jews are not, it's not viable to be a Jew elsewhere. Of course, today, ironically, the largest concentration of Israeli Jews, emigres from Israel, is in Berlin.
Now, I don't want to labor this parallel between Ukraine and Israel too much, but I think in practical terms, if we consider practical politics today, both the governments in Israel and in Ukraine are now largely constrained by this ethnic nationalism discourse, because you know, for politicians, it makes the room for maneuver very limited, and to some extent, they're always forced to continue upping the ante. And it's very dangerous, not only for them, but also for societies at large. What can possibly dissuade either the politicians or the populations from this kind of seeing themselves in those aggrieved terms, and to stimulate the idea that perhaps, you know, sure, we suffered in the past, but we can move to a better future?
Well, I think that in Israel, there is an awareness that we can move to the future. The question is, what kind of future? And as I just said, some Israelis who are more progressive, more liberal, feel very uncomfortable in today's Israel, even before this conflict in October. Many of them have emigrated. And those who go to Israel largely support the right-wing trend. So there is a continuation of that narrative of we are the victims, and the only place where can be take care of our fate is the State of Israel. And that's why such an innocent, apparently innocent, suggestion that Israel may become a state of all its citizens causes tremendous hostility in Israel, because the law of 2018 said that Israel is a state of the Jewish people wherever they live. So this idea of a liberal state of all its citizens, which is, I think, a normal concept for most countries today, well, is not so normal in Israel. And this, I think, really poses a problem, because on the territory that Israel controls more or less between the sea and the Jordan River, about half of the population are Palestinian Arabs, but they don't have political rights. So that's a source of the tension and hostility and all that. That's based, and why they don't have political rights? Because there is tremendous belief, I think, shared by most people in Israel, most Jews in Israel, that Jews have to be in the majority. And if there is no Jewish majority in Israel, that'll be the end of it.
Professor Rapkin, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Yakov Rapkin, Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Montreal. Professor Rapkin, I want to ask you one more question about this existential threat as a sort of structural factor in creating and mobilizing ethnic identity or national identity, because I think it's being used not only in Ukraine or Israel, but also in the United States. If we look at the American history, there's been hardly a decade over the past century when the Americans didn't have a major enemy either in the Soviet Union or in communism or in terrorism or most recently in authoritarianism. And I wonder what structural purpose do you think this existential or outside threat serves in the American context? Because unlike Ukraine or Israel, the United States is a large country and seemingly invincible in security terms. Why do you think the Americans need this to have an enemy?
Well, President Eisenhower, I think, indicated one reason when he was retiring from his position. His mandate was over as President of the United States, and he defined it as military-industrial complex. I think there are very practical reasons why the United States needs an enemy. The United States is not based on ethnic nationalism, it's something else. But it has to believe that it's a force of good with a capital G. And of course, if there is a force of good, there must be somewhere a force of evil, no less capital E. So evil can change. It could be, as you said, communism. It could be Saddam Hussein at one point or whoever. And no one asked the question, can Saddam Hussein really attack the United States? No one would even ask this question because it's a ridiculous question. So for the United States, I think there is tremendous interest, a very practical interest that President Biden alluded to 2 weeks ago. He said, we have to help Ukraine and Israel. That'll create jobs in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and so on.
I'm sure you would agree with me that the American support has been instrumental for creating Israel as we know it today, both military and political support. And there's been a number of publications, very interesting publications recently, about how Israel and prominent Jewish businessmen throughout the 20th century sought to influence the American discourse on Israel and to propagate this idea, especially among the American Christians, that somehow the second coming of Jesus is intrinsically linked to the political state of Israel. But I learned from your articles that you believe, at least, that this idea is not only pro-Zionist, it may be to some extent anti-Semitic. In what way?
You mentioned Christian Zionism, and it's good you mentioned it because Zionism originally is a religious Protestant evangelical movement, which emerged in the 17th century, became stronger in the 19th century, and the founder of political Zionism, Theodor Herzl, was influenced by one such Christian Zionist who was a chaplain at the British Embassy in Vienna. So there is a very strong connection historically. Now, in today's world, most supporters of Israel are evangelical Christians or Christian Zionists, both in the United States and elsewhere. And I would say that the mobilization of that support occurred largely through the efforts of Benjamin Netanyahu, who was Israel's representative at the UN and who spent enormous amount of time in American states where there are practically no Jews, but there are a lot of Christians. And he built up this support. And that support, I think, is crucial. And that's why association of Israel lobby with Jewish lobby is misleading, because Pastor Hagee said a few years ago, talking about an organization he was heading, Christians United for Israel, says, we are 50 million in the United States. If we trust him, then we have to remember that there are about 14 or 15 million Jews in the world, including babies and old people.
I also remember you writing that this ingathering of the Hebrews into Palestine, this idea was driven not only by the will to sort of speed up the second coming of Christ, but also a pretty cynical and anti-Semitic belief to sort of, or intention to get rid of the local Jews and get them moved over the other part of the world so that they do not live in my own neighborhood. And that's pretty striking. And do you think today's Christians who are so fervent in their support of the state of Israel are actually fully sort of cognizant of the underlying factors?
I think the link here, the link with anti-Jewish or anti-Semitism is twofold. One, you're totally right that people who are supporting the Zionist project, and most famously Balfour, who issued his declaration, his letter to Rothschild in 1917, was an anti-Semite. And that was a very normal thing among the British establishment. A few years before the Balfour Declaration that supported Zionism, he was opposed, as Minister of Interior, I think, to immigration of Russian Jews into Britain, because they're alien, they'll never assimilate and all that. So you have one person who sort of embodies that problem. Now, the second issue is this more theological issue. And one Israeli journalist who wrote a book about Christian Zionists put it very succinctly, and I'll quote him. He said, the Christian scenario, the Christian play of this second coming is a play in five acts, and we Jews disappear in the fourth one. Now, why is it so? Because according to that scenario, when the second coming occurs, Jews will have to choose either accept Jesus as a Messiah and then stop being Jews, so to speak, religiously, or perish.
We have always assumed that religion and politics should be separated, and yet I think this both this conflict and the one in Ukraine, the current political difficulties in the United States, do demonstrate how dangerous, if not lethal, it is to sort of try to blur the lines between politics, religion, ideology. Do you think politicians at this point of time will at least recognize the danger, if not in Israel, because the situation is so complicated, but let's say in the United States, do you think anyone will sort of learn lessons from how potentially dangerous it could be?
I'm not convinced. I'm not convinced at all. I think what may teach is something that may happen in practice and a blowback of sorts. What I'm concerned, and I think that's what you're alluding to, is the use of pseudo-religious terms to describe political events and military events today. When President Biden, again in his speech 2 weeks ago, spoke about unadulterated evil, you know, again, we're talking not about political realities, not about causes of that hostility or whatever, but about an existential struggle between good and evil. And once you put yourself in that framework, you cannot negotiate with evil. You can only destroy evil. And I think in today's political discourse, very often we have this pseudo-religious notes, which in my opinion, prevent peaceful resolution of all kinds of conflicts. Happily, it mostly occurs in the West. So I don't hear much of that in other countries.
But Professor Rapkin, I think it goes even further. I mean, obviously, it could be very instrumental for politicians to talk about, you know, existential threat or, you know, major evil. But the problem that they create for themselves is that, you know, that kind of electorate is easy to mobilize. You can mobilize people who are religiously passionate, but to govern them is very hard because they don't like to being governed. And I'm sure the Israeli leadership at this point, just like the American leadership, find it very challenging to, you know, move beyond the elections. You need the votes of these people for the elections, but to change a life in your country in a meaningful way, they make it very difficult. Don't you think so? That they themselves become an obstacle to normal, practical governance.
Well, it depends on what you call normal. I think that, say, in Israel, that's where we started our discussion, it's quite normal to refer to the idea of an ethnic state, that the only way we can survive is being a Jewish state, whatever that means. No one knows what Jewish state means.
But that's exactly my point. Surviving and living your life with pleasure are two very different things. I mean, if you are always surviving, you know, the quality of life is not that good after all. I mean, and I'm sure many Jews understand it right now, regardless of their political persuasions, because you want to be able to take your kid out in the park and not fear that, you know, some rocket will land in the neighborhood. And in order to do that, you also have to, you know, do certain amendments when it comes to your political and religious beliefs. I mean, all things are connected ultimately.
Indeed, and I think that the many more bourgeois liberal Israelis feel uncomfortable in today's Israel because it's become messianic, it's become very right-wing, nationalist, racist. And that's why you had a lot of manifestations, a lot of demonstrations against the current government from the beginning of this year. Actually, I was in Israel in spring, and there were huge, huge demonstrations against Netanyahu connected with the judicial reform. But beyond and behind that is the unease of the old secular elites, descendants of those Russian Jews, if you like, and Polish Jews, who feel uncomfortable in this new environment where you cannot negotiate anything because it's all becoming a religious issue. Many of them indeed want their children to go out in the park and play, and that's why many of them find themselves in Berlin or Montreal.
Well, sooner or later, I guess, an existential threat does become a self-fulfilling prophecy, even if you only try to use it as a political tool. Professor Rapkin, we have to leave it there, but I'm very grateful for you sharing your insights with us today.
Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.